This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome my next guest. This is amazing. I don't know where he has been all my life because I really could have used him. Oh, yes. I'm telling you, this man is so brilliant. It is amazing. I wish I had known about him when I was homeschooling my kids, because he has written a book that I think it's absolutely delightful. I think it's so funny. I just love it so much. And the name of the book is TOTUS, and the author is J. Joseph Kasdan. Hi. What do I call you? Joseph?
Joseph is perfect, Patsy. Thank you. And thanks for having me on your show. This is really fantastic.
Oh, well, you know, this is a thrill for me. I'll tell you something. I was a homeschool mom for years. And when I got this book, I was so thrilled with it. I thought, my goodness, if I would have only had this, because you're going to have to explain to my listeners what this book is about. But I will tell you, it was like I was waiting for you to write, to see this book. The fascinating thing is, you know, everybody knows that Marilyn Monroe was crazy about Einstein. She really admired him and really wanted to, you know, meet him and get to know him. What she would have done with you, I don't know. She'd have married you. Because your writing is so much fun. Your mind is so fantastic. I think that she would just, it's mind-blowing. It's just, few books have made me so happy as I was when I was reading this book. Because the theory that you have, you have to explain it, because it's difficult for people to really understand, you know, Our education system's not what it used to be, but explain what the book is about. But explain the characters that you are basing the story on.
Absolutely. So the book is essentially a symposium that takes place in an indeterminate time. It's kind of in the past. It's absolutely right here, right now. And this symposium is led by none other than Socrates himself. And he's there with seven of his very good friends who happen to represent some of the greatest minds and philosophers and artists and scientists the world has ever known. And so what they're doing in this symposium is they're discussing various and sundry things. But, of course, being Socrates and these great thinkers, they're discussing some very serious subjects as well. They begin with, how is it that we know anything about the world at all? It's a pretty basic question. But what they want to know is, by what process do we as conscious observers have an experience of reality? And so in their discussion, they discover that, well, guess what? This experience of reality is a biosensory creation. It is an interpretation of reality. And as we all know, an interpretation of a thing is not the same as the thing itself, just like a picture of a peach is not a peach. And so from there, understanding this idea that our experienced reality is actually a biosensory product and interpretation that we call the experience of life, they go on to look at the nature of space and time itself. Is time real? Are experiences of space and time as we have them, the way those objects or those phenomena actually exist?
Well, you know, I just have to say, when we're going to go back, because I need you to explain a little bit about the people who are involved in this. But it's like when I got to chapter 10, It was like I was waiting all my life to be able to read a sentence like this. I'm going to read it for my listeners. I hope I get it right. Because it's so wonderful. I love this sentence. I'm smiling so much. Anthropocentrism, I don't know if I pronounced that right, places human experience at the center of reality and distorts reality to comport with our experience of it. I know some of you people out there will think, why would you get such a kick out of that? But it is so good. That sentence, I read it a couple of times, and each time it put a smile on my face because it is just such a good sentence.
Excellent. I mean, you know, the many people, you know, who have read the book, they're one of their first comments is, it's so difficult to figure out what genre this book is. Where does it sit in the category list of books? And it is true as you that sentence alone kind of, you know, throws the whole thing for a loop. One of the things that is discovered by these great thinkers is that this creation of our biology, this experience of reality that our central nervous system and our biosensors create for us, it creates both an observer and the observations that it sees, the observer being the self and the observations being the world outside the self. And it's interesting how we don't really think that's a very strange thing, that we are observing things and all of this stuff is outside of our bodies that exists out there. And in reality, the entire world we are seeing and experiencing exists in our brains. It is an image created by our neurons that lives inside our biology.
Well, explain the great thinkers that you selected, because I found it a fascinating group of people.
So, essentially, there are seven people. And what I, you know, because it's a Greek symposium, I gave them Greek names. So there's Stephen Hawking is Geraki, which means hawk in Greek. Einstein is Mia Petra, one stone. Max Planck is Thanida for plank. Isaac Newton is Neotono, which literally means new ton in Greek. And there are a couple more who, right off the top of my head,
Louis Lagrange.
Oh, Lagrange is in there, exactly.
And Lagrange.
Robert Hooke is in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love...
Oh, Wacheronas.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I love Joseph Louis Lagrange because he was really deeply involved with algebra and quadratic equations. Mm-hmm. And I love quadratic equations. As a matter of fact, when I was a homeschool mom, I used to make a contest with the kids that they would have to, the one who solved the quadratic equations that I made for them, and I got to the point where I could make the most complicated ones ever. The one who got it fast was able to get a token, and then the tokens added up, and then they could use those tokens to buy prizes. Because
fantastic.
I think it's quadratic equations are more fun than crossword puzzles. People should really just do them for fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're important in math and in physics, obviously, the basis of very complex understanding of the way things relate and function amongst variables functioning amongst themselves. What was I going to say? Oh, so anyway, the characters that I created, not I created, but that I brought in here, because it's I wanted a symposium that was, something personal, something that was between real people. I had to have real characters. But at the same time, these characters are a composite of the thousands of people, the thousands of great thinkers over the eons who have contributed to our understanding of the world that we live in today and totally take for granted. So at one and the same time, I wanted a group of people that a reader could relate to personally, while at the same time, I wanted to incorporate all of the thinking, all of the great ideas and discoveries that so many people have made and that live on the pages of this book. I mean, these seven people, very important people, they stand on the shoulders of all these other people who stand on the shoulders of all these other people. So that's kind of how I see the group as a whole.
Well,
does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And it's fascinating what they're talking about, what they are trying to between themselves and explain to each other. I think it's just so beautifully written. And as you said, it's difficult to put it in any genre, but I would put it in, they should have a special genre just for books that you should read just for pure delight and a little bit of intellectual stimulation. They should have that, you know, like in Barnes & Noble, they should have just one. It wouldn't be a big shelf because not too many people can write as well as you do. But just to have that, it's just so much fun. And I hope that, you know, people, it's a small book, it's a few, like 100 pages, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
It is, at the end of it, your mind is like working over and over, like I mean, you can't keep up with these people. They are, you know, of course, amazing, each and every one of them. But it's fun to see what you've done with them.
Well, that is, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate that. It's a great shot in the arm to hear that, you know, because the concepts are challenging. And I think one of the things that works so well in the book and was like a revelation to me when I realized I could do this, because at first when I was writing this stuff down, you can imagine it was a mess. I mean, how do you write these ideas down and make sense of them? And then I remembered, you know, reading Plato in school, and I'm like, of course, let's have a symposium. This is the perfect format to allow knowledge and understanding to bloom like a rose, petal by petal, built one idea upon the next. And so in this symposium, the reader actually becomes part of the symposium. The reader's there. They're in charge of what they want to learn. There's a lot of discussion of scientific experiments and what they showed, what their results were, what they mean. But the most important part, of course, in a Socratic method of discovery are the conclusions that are reached as the symposium looks into what we thought was real, and then realized, oh, that was just something that I thought was true, but I never looked at it before. And so these conclusions build one after the other. So as you're there in the symposium with these characters, you are learning along with them. You get to ask yourself questions, answer the questions they're asking, ask other questions of the characters there, and just sort of think about what they might say about that. So I think that's one of the great things about the book. It just draws the reader in to become a part of the action that's actually happening.
It does. And, you know, the funny thing, one of the characters, of course, is Max Planck. And it reminded me of something. I always remembered this because he had a professor named Von Jolly. And Jolly. I suppose it would be pronounced Jolly. And his professor said, don't bother studying with physics, studying physics. Everything's already been discovered. And Max replied, I don't want to discover anything. I just want to understand. I want to understand what's going on as it right now. And I thought, that's exactly what this book does. It's just so much fun. I cannot tell people enough. We don't use we have these enormous number of brain cells. I mean, like Hercule Poirot said, I mean, we have millions of these brain cells. So few of them are used, certainly on a daily basis, so few of them are used. So if you get a book like this, which is sort of stretches your mind, opens up some of those gray cells that you don't know, and I think some people will investigate more these people.
Yes, absolutely.
I think that's one of the great things, that you'll have people actually going out and finding what Robert Hooke did. I mean, people don't know his name. They know the names of every star, all sorts of crazy people, that it doesn't do their minds any good. But if you know that just Robert Hooke alone is so fascinating, isn't he? It's just amazing.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think
the mathematicians kind of led the way.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're using a lot more of those gray cells, and it would help people if we would start using more of our gray cells. And I don't know if they're going to use this in a college. They can take this and do a whole semester on this book. Mm-hmm. I hope somebody's going to take it and say we're doing this as a college, one whole semester of actually getting young people to start thinking instead of.
Exactly.
I'm not even going to go there. It's one of the things that reminded me, as I said, I homeschool my kids, and I will never forget. That's why I wish I would have known you then. I was stuck in this traffic. I had to cross an 8-lane highway. I had to turn left, and I was waiting and waiting. I couldn't get the traffic was terrible. It didn't stop, and so I was going to then just turn right and then do a U-turn, and because there's no way I was going to cross into 8 lanes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going crazy. I was late for one of my kids was having a piano lesson. I was late. I was in a mood, and my son said to me, "Just think of the law of chaos. At some point, it will be okay. You will have a clear opening, and you can get through." And I.
How old is he?
And I said, "Well, this is a good one. How old is he?" He's 7 years old. I will add that he was accepted to Mensa when he was 5. So,
wow.
So he was right. He was right. He said, "Just wait. Don't try to get into traffic. It was a very dangerous road. The high speed, 80 miles an hour. People going." And right at one point, it just opened up. And there I could just go right across the whole 8 lanes. And he was
That's
right.
Fantastic.
And he's 7 years old. Now, he was always asking questions like are in this book. And I could not have that. I quickly, let's say at the age of 7, both of my boys finished algebra and they went into geometry. But they would have loved at that age to talk to you, because you would have been able to communicate with them on a level that I never was able to.
Kids have naturally open minds. They want to know. They want to learn. That's why they're always asking questions.
Exactly.
They're always telling them to shut up. Can I tell you a quick story?
Sure.
Very interesting story. So I was walking down the street in Seattle. I was going to meet my wife at a restaurant. I was in a residential neighborhood. I parked my car. And as I'm walking, I see a mother and her daughter, who's probably, I'd say, around 5. And her daughter is to the side looking at these beautiful flowers that are blooming. It's in the spring. And the mother's walking, obviously in a hurry somewhere, and she stops, and I come close. And the mother grabs the daughter's hand and says, "Hey, pay attention. Let's go." And she just kind of starts dragging her away. And I wanted to say to the mother, "Ma'am, she is paying attention. You need to pay attention."
I know.
And not lose your life just because you're in a freaking hurry. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love that story.
It was pretty amazing.
Well, that's true. And that's why when I homeschooled, I had no curriculum. I let them go where they wanted. One of them just wanted to do math for about 4 years, finished calculus by the age of 11. So, you know, I just let other subjects along the way, but whatever they wanted to study. That way I was never nervous. I never had this, this hour we're studying this, and this hour we're studying this, and this hour. I just said, learn what you want to learn.
And obviously they brought you along on the journey.
Oh yeah, I had to learn.
You would have to learn.
Well, you know, I didn't know how to do quadratic equations until they were 7 years old. Then I learned, and it turned out to be a lot of fun. You know, I don't know if this book has been turned into a play yet. Are you going to turn it into a play?
I haven't thought of it, but I'm writing my fourth book now, and it's a conversation between two people that could certainly be turned into a play. I'm thinking about it.
No, I would take this book and have all of them, all the characters, absolutely in a play, and in the background, sort of, you know, just walking through every once in a while, a ballet dancer. Just sort of a dancer, just not saying anything, not doing anything. Perhaps, and now that you mention the flowers, perhaps with one of these wonderful dresses that you just sort of sweep open and it turns into a flower or a butterfly. And just walking behind the guys as they're talking. And I hope that all feminists won't get crazy because you don't have any women in it. So we can have the women as floating around behind the guys, because these are minds that we should know about. These are people we should know about, and it would be so much better for our younger generation if schools would actually teach them. Oh my goodness!
The difference between critical thinking and rote learning are like the gulf is unbridgeable.
I know, and it's just so. This is why something like this, I think, would be so much fun as a play, and to put on as a play, and to take it as a university degree, also a semester, and at the end to have this play. I think it would be just wonderful. I really, somehow we have to get back. When I was young, I was, you know, in a place where we were poor. We didn't have any educational background. And I was always dreaming of going, when I started, because I started reading early, I used to dream about going to Oxford, where I had heard that you would take a subject and you would learn that subject. And then when it came time to get a degree, all you had to do was talk about the subject.
Right.
And I love that idea, because for me, that's how I homeschool my kids. I said, learn whatever you want to learn. And then, you know, be able, if you can explain it, then you know it, and that's it. You know, that's sort of.
Yeah.
But nowadays, I mean, they can't explain anything. They don't even bother with rote memory, let alone thinking.
That's true. I think so.
Oh, my.
We don't have to remember anything anymore.
I know. It's just terrible. They don't like. I had a way. Now, I'll just mention, as a homeschool mom, I had a way that I taught my kids dates. I made sugar cookies, and I, with icing, I put dates on them. You know, it might be 1492, it might be 1918, it might be 1066. But they didn't get that cookie unless they could tell me what happened in that year.
Oh, that's great.
And all the neighbor kids knew that. The neighbor kids were learning dates. I'll never forget, one mother came to me and she said, well, you know, Mark knows that World War II started, Pearl Harbor started in 1941. He said, you taught him. I said, no, I didn't teach him. I said, he ate it. You see?
Yeah, that's good. Learning does occur on all of these different levels, sense levels. And the more we can include in that learning, the more we actually retain that information. People forget about that.
Well, I think the book is delightful. I think you're delightful.
Thank you so much.
And as I said, if she was crazy, if Marilyn Monroe was crazy about Einstein, she would have married you, run off with you, forget Joe DiMaggio and everybody else. She'd just run off with you. I don't think we have any young stars today who are, how can I say, intellectually stimulated enough. You don't want to run off with some of these.
I know it seems to be a lot more about books. But, that's Hollywood. Come on, it always has been.
But definitely, J. Joseph Kasdan, do you have a website you want people to go to?
I do. My website is jjkasdan.com. That's jjkasdan.com. And I have a blog on there. I have all kinds of information on the various and sundry books I've written and links to a lot of information. So if you're reading the blog, you know how in the book there may be experiments and stuff that people may not be aware of or have not known about. Well, on the blog, you can just click a link and it'll take you to the information about that experiment.
Okay, we're short of time, but I think I would like you to come back. I will contact you. I'd like you to come back and talk about your other books, because Einstein was not joking when he said reality is merely an illusion, albeit a persistent one. This was not an illusion. We had a wonderful conversation today. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Patsy. Really, really appreciate it.
Okay.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Bye-bye now.
Okay,
we're going to go straight to commercial.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And at the end of the program, I'm going to have a special feature for all you NaNoWriMo writers out there, busy working on your novel for November. But right now, I'm turning to somebody who didn't write a novel. She wrote a gigantic, heavy book. I mean, it's enormous. And it's called Lost Cities, 100 Discoveries That Changed the World. And I am so happy. Well, she didn't write it all, I guess, because she is the general editor, Anne R. Williams. Hi, Anne.
Hi.
Wow, what a book. This is a heavy thing.
I am very happy to see it when it came. I was when it came in the mail.
Well, you should be so proud.
PDF.
Wow.
And, to actually see it in its physical form. I mean, it's like a child. You know, it's plump. It's healthy. It's handsome.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I'm happy to hold it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's wonderful to hold it. And it is absolutely delightful. The collection is so good. And, of course, when it's a National Geographic book, we know that it's just perfect. The photos are fantastic. The writing is fantastic. And you had the fun of editing it?
Well, actually, I did edit the whole thing, but I was in on this at the very beginning. An editor in National Geographic Books named Hillary Black reached out to me, and she knew that I had covered archaeology for decades, and she asked me to put together the initial list of 100 spectacular, interesting, impactful archaeological discoveries. And so I came up with a list of about 80 right off the top of my head. And then, you know, different people contributed different things, including my husband. And we ended up with about a list of 120, which we then trimmed back. The time was too short for me to write the whole thing, so I wrote about a third of the book, and then other writers wrote the other chapters. So that's how it kind of came together.
Well, it is beautiful. It's impossible to select which one you like the most, but one of the ones that I found so intriguing was this the Silk Road. There's a photograph here of this wonderful, wonderful gold crown that they found along the Silk Road. Do you want to explain that? That one?
Well, I think you're talking about the one.
Tilia Tepe, where they found this wonderful gold crown that comes apart. They could take it apart. These people were so clever. We don't have artisans like this today. I don't know.
No, we don't. Well, this was a wonderful story because this site was excavated by a man named Victor Serianidi, right before the challenging things were starting to happen in that part of the world. And winter was coming, and he had found these burials, and he knew he had to get them out of the ground. And so he excavated everything, and all of the gold pieces went into, storage in Kabul in Afghanistan. And then, of course, you know, wars came, and Afghanistan went through a very troubling time, and everybody in the archaeological community thought these things were lost, including this fabulous crown. It came from nomads, and of course, since they rode their horses from point A to point B, everything had to be able to be collapsed and put into saddlebags, and so that's why that crown was able to be disassembled. At any rate, when the U.S. and Europeans were able to go back into Afghanistan, everything thought that treasure had been lost. But it has been locked away and kept safe by Afghan curators and archaeologists. We have that treasure today, thanks to their bravery and their keeping that treasure safe.
Oh, because it terrifies you when you think that some horrible people might have gotten their hands on it and just melted it for the gold and not
right.
ever understood how difficult this work was, what brilliant artisan made this. It's so gorgeous. Having lived in Iran for many years, I watched goldsmiths, really talented goldsmiths, and they had still some that were absolutely talented. I wouldn't buy anything today from over there because it's not the same. But I was able to at that time. Actually, I watched a goldsmith who was 98 years old, and he was still making filigree. He made. I still have a ring that he made from filigree, from just these threads of gold. It's amazing what they can do.
Yeah. Well, my specialty is ancient Egypt, and so there's plenty of gold that comes out of that. We do have a number of things in lost cities dealing with ancient Egypt, including but not limited to the discovery of King Tutankhamun's tomb, which, of course, was chock-a-block full of glittering golden things.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, when you go to Egypt, one of the things that many people do who are interested in jewelry, they go to the jewelry store. You can have a piece of jewelry custom made for you, or you can buy what they have off the shelf. I've done that myself on a number of occasions. But the tradition continues in modern Egypt.
Well, all of it, what you know, is in this book, and especially the Troy section, the legend of Troy, and Schliemann, the story of Schliemann, I think is so fantastic, of how he discovered Troy.
Well, it is quite the crazy story. But I think that what we have to remember in the tale of Schliemann, which was so wonderful, he thought he had identified the site of Troy. He started digging. He found jewelry. He dressed his wife up in jewelry. There's a photo of his wife in the jewelry in the book. I think when we read that, it's interesting to remember that was sort of the beginning of archaeology. And people did just sort of pick a place and start digging, and they were looking for gorgeous, glittering, golden goodies. The field is very different now. It is a science now, and when you go to the field, an excavation is a very multidisciplinary effort. So you bring in a geochemist and a ceramicist and a physical anthropologist, and there are all sorts of specialties that come to bear on an archaeological excavation, which these days is about the slow, careful accumulation of facts about the past. But back in Schliemann's day, it was much more, free form and much more of a treasure hunt. But it does make a really fabulous tale.
And there are so many here, including, I think the story of the lost city of the monkey god is fascinating.
Well, that is another sort of interesting thing that does bring to mind the changes that are happening in archaeology as we speak because of new technology. The last chapter in the book gives a short list of the new technologies that are revolutionizing the field of archaeology and will continue to do so. Why am I bringing this up in connection with the city of the monkey god? Well, that was identified through LIDAR. It is a way of, It's sort of specialized aerial photography that is done over most especially forests. Then you bring that footage back to your lab software. And what it does is, you know, computers are wonderful because they're very patient. And the camera and the computer program look between all of the leaves in the rainforest. And I mean, even if it's only a millimeter, and it puts all of those little bits together to create an impression of what's on the ground. And so how that is revolutionizing, for instance, the study of the Maya. Archaeologists, if they can afford it, do LIDAR and are finding all sorts of things on the ground that they just would not have the woman power or the manpower to go tromping through the rainforest to find. So it's really revolutionizing our idea of archaeological sites and helping us identify places like the city of the monkey god that really were not on the radar screen of anybody outside of Honduras. And so, you know, it was very exciting to find that. And then once you found that, you have to do what's called ground truthing. In other words, you have to go on the ground and see whether what you've seen in this image is exactly what's there. And that is what that expedition was all about. They did indeed find that there was a lost city there, which is, you know, always very exciting.
Well, all of the stories are just, you can spend hours, and you will spend hours going through this book because there are so many. The Frozen Mummies of the Andes, the one I particularly like, of course, was the Shipwreck of the Mary Rose, because I lived in England a long time. And I love the birch bark one.
The Mary Rose was the thing that my husband contributed.
Yeah? Oh, that's the one.
I started for many years, and he came into my office when I was putting together this list, and he said, "Have you included the Mary Rose?" And I said, "Well, no." And I looked it up. For those of you who don't know, it was a warship belonging to Henry VIII of England, and it got into a fight with a French fleet, and it sank and went to the bottom of the sea right off the southeastern coast of England, and there it lay until the 1960s. But because it was underwater, and because so much of it was ended up being covered in silt, it was preserved. So most of the structure of the boat and many of the individual things that the sailors had in their cabins, the things they brought from home, the things they worked with, that was all preserved. And so everything that was able to be rescued, the purpose-built museum in Portsmouth, England.
I know. I made a pilgrimage there because it is so fantastic. I lived in England for quite a few years. I bought a house, about a 400-year-old house there. So I really was deeply involved in English history. And boy, when I had the opportunity to go there, I was so thrilled. It's a thrilling experience to know. You know, and I was so happy that I don't like when I know people say, well, why bring it up? Let it sort of stay there, and you know, that's where it landed. I believe in bringing it up because I think it's thrilling to see this, you know, what they brought up.
Well, I think if people are interested in doing it and there are funds to not only bring it up, but properly preserve it, conserve it, curate it, put it in a museum. I mean, I think that's a great thing. It is a chapter from history that is very unusual, and it's great for people to see. I mean, I think that brings up two points that where I think this book is great. You know, first of all, it is great for armchair travelers or for travelers who want to figure out where their next place to go is. You know, you can go to Portsmouth and see this.
Exactly. It's inspiring. It's an inspiring book.
It really connects us all to that long experience of human existence. And it really allows us to think about all the people in our past who were so creative and inventive and resilient. And they went through tough times, and they got through it, and they left us these really wonderful legacies. And I think we have to hope that we will be able to do the same thing for our own descendants. We have so many benefits that our ancestors did not have. We have modern science. We have modern medicine. We know all sorts of things that our ancestors didn't know. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to go forward and really create wonderful things.
You're right. And that's why I have created my just on my own that Thanksgiving is Nat Geo Gift Day. And I believe that everybody should get a Nat Geo book, one, to have it there so people can go through it while you're busy in the kitchen. And this book is a perfect one. It's called Lost Cities, 100 Discoveries That Changed the World, and written a great deal by Ann R. Williams, who's also the general editor, and a beautiful introduction by Douglas Preston. And Lost Cities, Ancient Tombs. It's a wonderful book. This is exactly what I'm telling everybody. Get a gift for somebody. The holidays are coming up. Thanksgiving's coming up. Make this a gift. It will be treasured forever, and people will get hours, and I mean really so many hours of joy and inspiration from this book.
I think, you know, you can sit down and read this book if you have a couple hours, or if you just have 2 minutes, you can open it up and read a chapter. I mean, we designed it that way. The chapters are short.
Yeah.
So it can serve a lot of different needs. National Geographic is now part of Disney, so I've just looked this up. If you go to books.disney.com, you will be able to find this book.
Okay, that's great.
And be able to buy it online.
All right. Well, Anne, thank you so much for joining me today on Joy on Paper. It's always a joy to talk to anyone from Nat Geo, because I started traveling because of you guys. So thank you so much for being part of Joy on Paper.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This has been great.
Okay, bye-bye now. All right. That's great. We don't have much time, but we have time to play something. For all you NaNoWriMo writers out there who are sending me these messages, here is something from Jim Lamb.
What does Derek Zoolander have in common with Holden Caulfield? Or Wonder Woman with Jane Eyre? Each is a protagonist, a shining star, whether on the page, the stage, or silver screen. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. When it comes to storytelling, protagonists stand in the spotlight. They are primary, numero uno, of chief importance, VIPs. What they do or say affects everything and everybody. What kind of characteristics do protagonists have? It varies. They might be strong, courageous, and honorable, but with a flaw. For example, in Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones was definitely heroic, except when it came to, you know, snakes. What about Superman? Wow! Now there's a super-duper hero, right? Except for, you know, kryptonite. Hilary Swank won an Oscar for playing Maggie Fitzgerald in Million Dollar Baby. What a great performance, except, spoilers, she dies in the end. How about Erin Brockovich? She's heroic in real life, as well as a movie. Not many people can do that. Plus, she's still alive. So let's see. Where were we? Oh, yeah. Protagonists are people, just like you and me. Except they're not. They run into danger while the rest of us flee. They take on the villain at high noon while we hide in the corner. And sometimes, in saving everyone else's life, they die. Like Natasha, a.k.a. Black Widow. What motivates protagonists? Many things. They might be seeking long-lost treasure, like Indiana Jones, or trying to save a family member, as John Wayne did in The Searchers. Or, like Ripley in Alien, they're fighting a horrible, slimy monster. Yuck. Protagonists live complicated lives. Something always goes wrong. There are obstacles, false starts, setbacks, betrayals, mistakes. Good plans go bad. Bad things get worse. So whether it's the witch in Wicked or Kermit in the Muppet movie, remember this. It isn't easy being green. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about protagonists.
Okay, well, all of you people out there, keep writing. You can write right through Thanksgiving weekend. And boy, at the end of November, you will be a winner of the NaNoWriMo. Because it is, you know, I am so thrilled with both of the authors I had today. They've enjoyed writing their book so much. And you can just hear it in their voices when they're talking about the books that they've worked on. And this is what you will find. This is why I named this program Joy on Paper. Because remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to hear, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, and then to hear your words in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, a streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel, and you never know. And speaking of streaming video, I am going to replay for Thanksgiving Day my interview with Lee Child and his brother Andrew Child, or as we all know him as Drew here on Joy on Paper. And I'm going to replay that on Thanksgiving Day. So if you missed it, you have the opportunity to hear it again, because it was so much fun to talk to them, because we mostly talked about their childhood and about their life in Birmingham. And I think it was so fascinating, and I hope that you will enjoy listening to that. Meanwhile, everybody have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving, and make sure that you say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed. I am thankful for Big Ed. I am thankful for him all the time, because he is so wonderful. And again, just have a wonderful, wonderful Thanksgiving. And Ed saluted me, and I saluted him, because I should have been a general. Oh, I would have been a great general, and I'd have a wonderful pension today. Well, gee, I missed it. Okay, bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZH